Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are talking with a man whose work I admire very much and who was single-handedly responsible for exposing me to the idea that our official statistics on inflation, unemployment, and the GDP should not be trusted blindly. Ideas now enshrined in the Crash Course chapter I've entitled Fuzzy Numbers. His name is John Williams, and he runs the website shadowstats.com and offers consulting services to companies that need reliable data to manage their operations. Oh, what a pleasure. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
It's a great pleasure to be talking today. Why don't we begin by having you explain to our audience how you came to create the ShadowStats Government Statistics Service?
Sure. I've been a private consulting economist for about 30 years, and one of my early clients was a large commercial airplane manufacturer. Their primary forecasting tool was a number called revenue passenger miles, and they had a model, an econometric model, based on a number of factors, including the gross national product, which at the time was the measure used for the broadest measure used for the U.S. economy. The model had stopped working, and I looked at the detail and realized there was a problem with the gross national product reporting. There's a problem actually in the trade statistics, which I corrected privately, and the revised numbers worked quite well, and it did for some time until the changes in economic reporting made the numbers almost the GDP, GNP numbers, the GDP numbers, almost worthless. As I found early on with that, I really had to concentrate on what was being reported by the government if I ever wanted to be able to give a meaningful forecast or explain what was happening. I got into the numbers with people who'd been involved in the creation of the series, people who'd been in the business back into the 20s, and those that had worked for the government. I surveyed the National Association of Business Economists for several years at their annual meetings, and would ask the economists attending how they viewed the quality of government statistics. Generally, about 70% thought the numbers were pretty poor quality. And the interesting thing I found was in talking with people who knew specific numbers. For example, the economist for a very large retailer told me that the retail sales numbers put out by the government were virtually worthless to them. They didn't have much meaning in terms of their sales. They thought they were very poor quality. He, however, thought the money supply numbers were of good quality and liked to rely on them. And so helped me, the next guy that was filling out the survey and we talked was an economist for a large New York bank, and he said, you know, the money supply numbers are just of miserable quality, but I think the retail sales numbers are pretty good. And what I found was that the people who knew the ins and outs of the specific reporting knew where the flaws were, knew where the problems were, and in fairness to the government, it's very difficult to put together meaningful economic statistics on a timely basis. But a lot of series have been generated and very carefully followed over time. The problem is a key series such as the CPI inflation, the consumer price index, the employment numbers, the gross domestic product, over the decades have tended to move away from what seems to be common experience. And in fact, even in the late 90s, the Kaiser Foundation and the Washington Post surveyed consumers as to what they thought the rate of inflation was, what the GDP was, the economic activity, what unemployment was. The gist of the article was, ho, ho, look how stupid the American people are. They think inflation's double what it is, and economic growth is about half what it is. But the joke there was on the surveyors, because what the average guy sees and thinks is happening generally is a lot closer to, I think, what most people would perceive as reality than the government reporting. And the reason that the reporting has strayed so much from what at one time was something that was more in line with reality is that there have been changes to methodologies over time that tend to put upside biases into the economic reporting and downside biases into the inflation numbers. Those numbers are, I mean, over time, the biases are one way of manipulating the data, and that probably is a dominant form of how these numbers have been massaged over time to show happier news. You do get occasional one-shot interventions or manipulations, and it happens on both sides of the aisles. Both sides of the aisle. I mean, back in the Johnson administration, President Johnson was noted for regularly reviewing the what were then again the GNP numbers, and if he didn't like the report on the economy, he'd send it back to the Commerce Department, keep doing so till the Commerce Department got it right. In the case of first George Bush administration, President Bush was faced with a re-election bid against Bill Clinton. He had a recession at hand. Someone from the Commerce Department went to a large computer manufacturer, said, "Hey, folks, we got to get George reelected here. Can you boost your reporting of computer sales to the Bureau of Economic Analysis?" Bureau of Economic Analysis is the entity that reports on the GNP, the GDP. And they did. And the economy, reporting on the economy improved. The president said, "Whoa, recession's over, economy's booming." People thought he was out of touch with reality. If you recall the time, and in fact he appeared so, and again here you see the average person, Main Street USA, again has a pretty good sense of what's really going on. Not what's seen with these statistics. Probably the most egregious area of change, the one that has had the most impact on people, has been with the inflation numbers, with the consumer price index.
Well, how does that really impact people? So look, you know, if I'm just going to play devil's advocate. So if they're a little bit fudged, maybe this is the equivalent of a white lie. It's a harmless fib. How does this really impact people?
It's far from harmless. And from the economic side, you know, that can affect people's investment decisions, corporate planning. If you're using bad numbers there, you may have some shocks in terms of the return that you eventually get back on your portfolio or how a sales program works. From an inflation standpoint, a lot of people have an inflation adjustment either to their wages or a cost of living adjustment to Social Security payments. Or from the standpoint of an investors generally like to beat inflation with their returns. And if you're underestimating inflation, you're not going to get an adequate return. You're going to, for the individual who's seeing his salary not increase as much as you might expect otherwise, he's not staying ahead of inflation. And that's deliberate. That's deliberate because if you look at the way the CPI was used broadly in the early automotive contracts as a cost of living adjustment for wages, the concept at that time was it measured a fixed basket of goods, that the CPI effectively measured the cost of living of maintaining a constant standard of living. Using very simplistic terms, they'd take the price of a pound of beef, a gallon of milk, a gallon of gasoline. They'd price those out, and then they'd price out those exact same commodities the next year. And however much the package had increased by, that was the rate of inflation. That's how much your income had to increase if you wanted to maintain the type of standard of living you'd had the year before. In the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, Alan Greenspan and Michael Boskin, who then was head of the of George Bush's, first George Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, started on a program saying, "Oh, the CPI overstates inflation." And if you'd ask them why the CPI overstated inflation, their point would be, well, steak gets too expensive. People tend to buy more hamburger. If they might buy more hamburger, then their cost of living is lower. And while that might be true, That's far removed from the concept of the CPI as a measure of the cost of living of maintaining a constant standard of living. Nonetheless, they pushed through a number of changes with that. The effect is, and the stated purpose, why are you pushing this? Why do you want to do this? And you'll see this reiterated in the recent proposals by the Deficit Commission that the President put together, that the because the CPI is overstated, if we can only reduce it adequately to a realistic level, in this case they're talking basically just artificially reducing the CPI, then the cost of living adjustments for Social Security will be less, and that'll help reduce the budget deficit. And what was not said, of course, that was done without anyone in Congress having to do the politically impossible thing of voting against Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Social Security checks today would be about double what they are had these changes not been made. The unemployment rate is an area that I publish in an alternative measure, and I also publish in an alternative measure on inflation on the CPI. I try to give people an estimate of where the numbers would be if these key statistics were reported the way they were initially, at a time when it was more a coincident with common experience.
Yeah. Now, before John, before we move on to unemployment, I just have to ask you while I've got you here. So as I understand, Boskin Commission on inflation, they came up with three new ways that we're going to deal with these things. Substitution, which you mentioned, is maybe steak becomes too expensive, so we flip to a lesser grade of meat. There's weighting, so there's all sorts of issues around how weighting gets done. And then my favorite, I think everybody's favorite, of course, hedonics. My question around hedonics is, I get the idea underlying it, but here's why I worry it's a one-way trip. Yes, it's true that the cell phone I buy this year has many more features than the one I had 3 years ago, but my grandmother had the same phone for over 60 years. So I see that hedonics is adding value for the new features, but it's not ever deducting, and or correct me if I'm wrong, for the fact that products have a much shorter life cycle than they used to. Is that true?
Generally, that's true. And in fact, you rarely see, although you will see it, you'll rarely see hedonics that end up increasing the cost of the product. For example, if you were to apply hedonics to air travel, how would you account for the delays and all the problems in terms of security inspections now at the airport that you didn't have some years ago? None of that's accounted for. And I think the concept, while fine academically, and where the academics want to play games with it, the average guy doesn't look at it whatsoever in terms of his cost of living. For example, you have an additive that's put into gasoline at the direction of the federal government. This is supposed to improve air quality. Price of gasoline goes up 10 cents per gallon as a result. That actually happened, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics did not count that in the CPI because it was considered a quality improvement.
Hmm.
Well, for the guy that's looking at inflation and these inflation measures for his cost of living, or what he wants in the way of return on his investments, he's sitting there pumping a gas at the gas station. He isn't thinking, thank goodness I'm paying an extra 10 cents per gallon here that I'm not accounting because it's going to improve air quality. You know, he looks at it and he says, well, gee, the price of gas is going up. I don't have as much cash left over. And for purposes of the CPI, the way most people use it, getting all this fuzzy price adjustment because people have some kind of a quasi-quality improvement that the government cannot measure. Government can measure certain quality changes. For example, you buy a candy bar, and it's packaged a certain size, and it says 8 ounces on it. Next month, it comes in the same size, but they actually shrunk the candy bar inside and put six ounces on it. The Bureau of Labor Statistics notes that, and they account for that, and they change the inflation for the effect of that. And that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very quantifiable effect in terms of the price of goods and what you're getting. But when you get into the hedonics, I mean, for example, computers, that's a big area. And this is an area that has distorted the gross domestic product reporting as well, because the gross domestic product, the broadest measure of U.S. economic activity, commonly is reported adjusted for inflation. Inflation's taken out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher the rate of inflation you use, the lower the growth you're going to end up with. The lower the rate of inflation you use, the stronger the growth will be. And amazingly enough, the government's biases here are to use the lower rate of inflation, which gives you the stronger growth. Now, granted, computer technology has expanded significantly over the last decade, over the last year or two. People now use computers as television. And the government will try to adjust that into their pricing of a computer. My argument there would be, yep, there's certainly some quality improvement, but if you're now selling a computer and television, count that as a separate product. When I buy a computer, I use it as a computer. 10 years ago, I bought a computer system for $1,000. According to the government, with all the quality changes, I should be able to buy that same computer today for $50. not a chance. I have two computers sitting on my desk. One I bought 10 years ago, one a lot more recently. Also cost me $1,000. I actually prefer the one from 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't use all the bells and whistles. So there's somewhere in between what the government does with their manipulations on computers and not counting them at all probably is there's an element of reasonableness and reality. But as it's handled, the improvements in computers are very overstated in terms of their effect on inflation, in terms of reducing inflation.
Right. I've had computers for a couple decades, too. I still type at the same speed I always typed at. Doesn't really matter to me what the clock speed is on my CPU. I don't know that I'm all that much more productive. And the truth is, you needed that same $1,000 computer to participate in the operating systems of the time, and today you still need the same $1,000 computer because you can't run an old computer on new stuff. So it's a very slippery slope, but I've noticed that slope is one way. I've not personally yet run across an adjustment which has gone in the direction of making something appear more expensive or inflation higher. Have you?
There have been some that the government has touted, but it depends how things are going. For example, with textbooks for the classroom, they make an adjustment, a quality adjustment, if there are colored pictures in it. If I'm a student, I don't care much about the color pictures. I'm looking at what it's going to cost me to buy my books for this semester.
Yeah.
And so the whole point I'm making here is that when you're looking at inflation for either what your cost of living is and maintaining a constant standard of living, or be looking at this as an investment, what kind of a return do I need to get in order to stay ahead of inflation? You're looking at what your out-of-pocket expenses here. You're not looking at the hedonics and the theoretical pleasures that you're getting from these products that the government's trying to offset against your cost of living. So what I do is, I mean, if you look at the old series, the government's been very good in reporting a number of the changes they've made in their estimated impact on the annual rate of inflation. There's some that they haven't published estimates on. One is they used to reweight the consumer price index every 10 years. Now they reweight it every 2 years, which gets you into that hamburger steak conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't, it's not fully substitution-based yet. They have one that they call the chain-weighted CPIU. It's experimental, but this is the one that the Budget Commission is advertising as being the best inflation measure. But it's not if you're looking, again, at a constant standard of living. But if using the CPI the way it was before they started with these games, if you look at the changes made since 1990, and I look at it pretty much on an additive basis based on the government's estimates of what these different changes have added or subtracted to the reported CPI inflation, where right now the CPI year over year is showing 1.5% inflation. If you went back to the way it was calculated in 1990, you'd be up to something close to 5%. And if you went back to the way it was calculated in 1980, mm-hmm. you'd be looking at something up in the area of 8 or 9%.
8 or 9%. That's a full 6.5% to 7.5% higher than what we're being told it is right now.
Right. The difference between my numbers and the government's numbers basically is what is being lost in measuring the cost of living of maintaining a constant standard of living. That means if you're keeping up with the CPI as the government publishes it, you're seeing a declining standard of living.
Okay, so the part that gets me as well, and I know this is really hard. I understand you can't have a single inflation measure. It really depends. I have three children who are pre-college age. So when I look forward, I have a very different view of inflation potentially because I'm trying to factor in those college costs compared to where I was when I was 18, or somebody who's past child rearing age and is trying to live on a fixed income and has a lot of prescription drugs. So
right.
How is it that is there any method out there where people can understand better what their personal rate of inflation is, or do we is a single sort of aggregated average rate the best we can do?
The federal government actually does publish a couple of experimental measures aimed more at senior citizens or younger people. They have that available on their site. It's subject to the same problems that I'm talking about with the CPIU. It's just a matter of how you weight the cost. and consumption. I mean, you could, for example, go through the CPI and look at the weightings there and say, oh, you know, my weighting in this area is such and such, and you could change the weightings and calculate your own estimate. I have not done a separate work in that area, but it is doable.
Okay, so let me just take that one piece for a minute, though, because I think there's still a problem here. I think there's still a problem, even if we were going to use this experimental weighting. And here's why. When I was looking at the CPI for last year, medical care services went up 3.9%. I think that's goods and services.
Uh-huh.
And but whenever I look at what the insurance companies are trying to claim in terms of, you know, justifying the rate increases, they're speaking to numbers of that are three times higher than that. How can we have a gap that large between what companies are experiencing and reporting and seemingly justifying with lots of data to rate commissions and what the federal government is reporting through the CPI?
Well, it again depends on how the government's surveying it, what assumptions that they make. I would go with the practical, the real world experience in terms of what you're seeing as opposed to what the government's reporting.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly experiencing a much higher rate of inflation, and I note also that when we get to the GDP calculations and unemployment or employment numbers, you're calculating unemployment that's, I think, a little higher than twice as high as the currently reported headline number. Is that about right?
That's actually, yeah, it's a little more than that. I'm up around 22%, where the headline number's at 9%.
Mm-hmm.
Again, here, what you're looking at here is a matter of definition. The federal government's pretty forthright in terms of how it measures things. You read the footnotes. In terms of their unemployment rate, it's accurate if you go along with their definitions within a certain standard margin of error.
Mm-hmm.
They publish six levels of unemployment, of the unemployment rate. U3, their third level, is the headline number, the one that for January came in at, I think it was 9%. Their broadest measure, U6, came in at 16.1%. And that included, beyond the components of the headline number, people who are marginally attached to the workforce, those such as discouraged workers, people who meet all the qualifications of being employed or unemployed but haven't looked for work in the last 4 weeks, which is one of those qualifications, everything but that. And as long as they've looked for work in the last year, they're counted as a discouraged worker. 1994 and before, the discouraged workers didn't have that one-year time limit on them. And that's where some of the numbers start to go awry, because the discouraged workers are not counted in the labor force. So when you see the labor force shrinking, that can reflect people who are giving up looking for work. It doesn't mean that they're not unemployed or that they wouldn't take a job if one were available. In fact, quite to the contrary. They are unemployed. They consider themselves unemployed. They'd take a job if they could get it. And if you went around the country, asked everyone whether or not he or she was unemployed, not only would you get pretty rapid answers, but if you totaled it up, I think you'd come up with something closer to my estimate of 22% than what the government's putting out there, because primarily of these discouraged workers. Because the discouraged workers in the U6 number, after a year, just fall off the government records. If they've been discouraged for a year, they're no longer tracked. And I estimate the longer-term discouraged workers added in on top of the U6 to come up with my estimate of 22%. Now, I have people say, oh my goodness, that's getting pretty close to the 25% that was the peak unemployment hit in the Great Depression. Well, that's true to a certain extent. Keep in mind that the unemployment rate in the peak in the Great Depression was estimated after the fact. The government didn't start surveying unemployment until 1940. The government's estimate was based on the 1930 federal census, early applications for Social Security, a variety of statistics, but not a formal surveying of unemployment. But the nature there was measuring the universe, as I'm looking at it, people who think they're unemployed as opposed to those who are defined as more narrowly as unemployed because they've looked for work in the last 4 weeks. If, again, beyond the last 4 weeks, they're not in the headline number, they're not in the labor force. Yet in the Great Depression, 1933, something like 20% of the population was working on farms. Mm-hmm. Today, the agricultural employment's less than 2%. And if you looked at the non-farm unemployment rate estimated for 1933, you're up around 35%. I think that'd be closer in terms of comparison to what I'm looking at than the aggregate number that's bandied about. What I'm seeing right now is basically as bad as it's been in this downturn, and really as bad as it's been since World War II.
So the recovery that we've seen so far in the official statistics is not showing up as much in your recombined statistics.
Nope, and there we have some serious reporting problems with a variety of statistics beyond what I've discussed here. That comes as fallout of the nature of this extraordinary downturn that we've been in. This is the most severe in terms of depth and length, most severe contraction we've seen since the Great Depression. And the modern economic reporting system, pretty much put into place after World War II, never was designed to handle a downturn of this magnitude. And what you're seeing right now, seasonal factors that are so key and most of the monthly statistics are virtually worthless. They're heavily distorted by the economic cycle and no longer reflecting the usual cyclical patterns from holidays or whatever. I mean, they reflect that as well, but the economics is dominated. You don't have stable seasonal adjustments. So that's throwing off some of the current unemployment numbers. It's throwing off retail sales. We just had a benchmark revision to the payroll employment, which is a different series and which suffered some other issues. But what that is showing, even allowing for whatever seasonal patterns you want to put in there, is that the level of employment today is below where it was 10 years ago. And yet, in that period of time, the U.S. population's grown by 10%. We're not seeing an economic recovery here. This is the downturn started end of 2007 officially, so plunging activity through 2008 into 2009, pretty much been bottom bouncing since. You've had some bounces from short-lived economic stimulus, but we're not seeing a fundamental economic recovery. And the reason you're not seeing a fundamental economic recovery is that we have some structural issues here that simply are not being addressed.
So we've had a statistical recovery, which maybe is not surprising because the Fed drives by statistics. So they've dumped money into the right places in order to get a statistical recovery. But what you're saying is the base data is not showing us a sustained recovery. We're not seeing the typical upturn that we would see in a post-recessionary period. Is that fair?
Well, reasonably so. The thing is, even with the numbers that have shown some uptick, such as retail sales, it looks like they have topped out. When you adjust for inflation, retail sales, most of the gain in retail sales last month, I say last month, that was in January reporting. Tomorrow we'll be seeing February reporting. Most of the gain was due to inflation. And if you take inflation out of it, you're not seeing growth in retail sales. That's an important factor because the way the gross domestic product is calculated is net of inflation. So that the recovery is only due to inflation, that's not a good sign. Industrial production also appears to have peaked. The housing market, housing starts, have started to turn down anew. I mean, we're not just looking at bottom bouncing here. We're looking at it beginning to fall off a cliff again.
Yeah, particularly in some key markets that had thought to have been resistant. We saw that article in the New York Times, I believe, yesterday, noting that Seattle has finally figured out that they had a housing bubble, too.
Well, it'll be called a double dip because the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the arbiter of business cycles in the United States, called an end to this recession back in June 2009. And then they don't change those calls. So the renewed downturn will be a double dip recession. It, in reality, is an ongoing economic disaster. When I say there's a structural change, the problem here, very simply, is that the average consumer can't make ends meet, and that's been an increasing problem over the decades, largely due to the loss of higher-paying production jobs to offshore competition. If you go back to the 1970s, before the 1973 recession, and if you look at the government's own numbers on average weekly earnings and using their inflation numbers, you'll see that the average weekly earnings, that's on a personal basis, peaked just before the 73-75 recession. Never recovered. We're down. They're still down 10% plus. As that began to unfold, the way the households reacted explains much of the way our society is structured today. Back in the 70s, it was much more common for one person in a household to work. Usually the husband, the wife would stay home with the kids. Today, it's much more common that both husband and wife work, maybe someone else in the family as well, in order to make ends meet. But if you look at the government's latest statistics, the poverty survey of 2009, which was the most recent release, both average and median household income adjusted for inflation. And that's a, they use a really gimmick low inflation rate with that one, shows that not only is household income been falling the last year or two, but it's below its near-term peak and before the 2001 recession. Household income has not recovered above that. And if you use the CPIU, the usual inflation rate, they deflate that by instead of the gimmicked one, that would that shows that household income today is below where it was in 1973. Again, the average household has not been able to keep up here. Now, if income growth is not keeping ahead of inflation, very simply, you can't have consumption growing faster than inflation on a sustainable basis. You can buy some growth short term through debt expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Greenspan was aware of that back in, go back a decade and a half, 2 decades ago. He saw what was coming here, that the basically the economy was what was going to be grinding to a halt in real or inflation adjusted terms, and rather than have a regular cycle and let the problems in the system have their shakeout, he basically encouraged debt expansion to keep the economy growing, and you saw a debt leverage built upon debt leverage, and that is what's started to collapse in this last year or two. So right now, I mean, consumer lending, the consumer debt outstanding, I mean, it had a little bit of a bounce up in the last couple of months with some student loans and such, but year over year, it's still down sharply. Business loans with banks are down. Unless you have growth in debt, growth in income, you can't have growth in consumption, which is 70% of the economy.
You know, I chase it back to, if you look at the M3 figures back when we had them, bless their heart, 94-95, we saw both of leveling out of money growth and credit. And that was the period of time where I chase all of this back to. That was a key decision. Something happened there, and it was the maestro, Greenspan. What he did was he opened something called sweeps, which allowed banks to effectively reduce the reserve requirements to near zero, because they could take demand accounts, sweep them into non-demand money market accounts at 12 o'clock, take a snapshot, book reserves based on that snapshot, which was fictitiously low, sweep everything back in at 1201, call it a day. It was fraudulent as far as I was concerned. They should have just come out and said, we've eliminated reserve requirements. And from there, you know, we went into a nice tidy asset bubble in stocks, and then that blew up. And of course, the Fed had to fix that, so blew it up into a housing bubble. And so the real question is, you know, where, you know, here we are. It seems like all the chickens have come home to roost. And it's very unclear to me what the encore to that particular story is, because they've tried most of the tricks I can think of. Now we're in the period of expanding government debt. That seems to be, you know, the fallback position. We have a lender and a borrower of last resort. But it's really unclear to me, as you're, you know, mentioning, it's the consumer demand that drives an economy. It's not government demand.
Let me put it this way. The healthy economy is driven by consumer demand.
Okay, excellent.
That's sustainable. Everybody's happy. People are making money. When it's being driven by the government, that is an unhappy circumstance, because people are having their money taken by the government, and the only people getting richer, the politicians in Washington, are those living off the government,
yeah,
if you can call that getting rich. But we have a circumstance here which is not sustainable, and one that has a cost, which will be eventually, and perhaps real soon, in inflation. You have a circumstance where back in 2008, the Fed and the Treasury were saying, oh my goodness, the system's going to collapse, we're going to have a Great Depression, we have to get this big stimulus package put together. They weren't kidding that the system was on the brink of collapse. We should not have been there, but keep in mind that the Fed's primary function here is not to contain inflation or maintain economic growth, but rather it is to support the banking system and keep it stable. It's an independent corporation owned by the generally by the commercial banks.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the collapse of the banking system, which was a potential there, just unacceptable, not an option for the Fed. Likewise, the Treasury, the federal government wouldn't tolerate a collapse of the system. So they, what they did was they put together whatever they had to put together, created whatever money they had to put in, whatever guarantees, stopgaps they had to create in order to keep the system from collapsing. Now that, they may have gone overboard in certain areas, but as they viewed it, that had to be done. Otherwise, failure for the, complete failure for the Fed, complete failure for the federal government. What has happened since then, though, is not encouraging because the economy is not recovering. And there are a lot of signs that the systemic solvency crisis is very much ongoing. I still track M3, and we put together the numbers basically from what the Fed publishes. And what we're seeing now is that after a brief upturn on a month-to-month basis, that's starting to turn down again. That's usually a sign of it's a big warning sign for the economy, but it's also a sign that there's a problem in the banking system. Banks are not lending money, and I'll contend, yes, I'm sure there's some concern there about loan quality, but I think the primary problem is that the banks are having balance sheet problems that inhibits their ability to lend money. And without the growth in debt, again, you're faced with a circumstance where you're not going to see any kind of a rapid economic recovery.
All right. Well, I want to shift gears on that then, because I'm very interested, and all of our listeners are very interested in where this goes. So I want to talk maybe 2011, 2012. And you've been fairly outspoken in your predictions that there's a hyperinflationary end to the U.S. economy. Other people are calling for a deflationary end.
Yep.
But tell us what you see and the main drivers for that prediction and sort of how you see that unfolding. This brings us to the end of part one of this podcast with John Williams. Part two is reserved as a benefit for enrolled members. And if you join us there, you can enter a wide-ranging discussion with other members about the implications of John's predictions and what you can do to prepare for them. Thank you for listening.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.